This week, an exclusive press release from the Southern California Research Lodge. A research lodge with a press release? What could be so amazing? Then we take a look at the duties of a Freemason, whether entered apprentice, fellow craft, or master mason. What exactly is your duty to the lodge in a practical sense? Then we'll hear from illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison as he tells the tale of a man separated from his family and in his last will asks for his hand to be cut off and buried with his wife. We'll wrap it up with perhaps a controversial piece. What does the Electoral College offer in the spirit of politics and voting when viewed through the lens of Freemasonry? Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 462. Right off the bat, I want to go ahead and thank our producers, our fellows, and our contributors who make this show happen week after week, year after year. If you'd like to know more about how to support this show, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and you'll find out how you can do that. Now, last week we wrapped up our four-part series of A Timeline of Freemasonry, which is about a 100-page paper that was written by G.W. Sibley. It was pretty great. It gave a decent and a fair, accurate account of Freemasonry, than I thought, anyway. Let me know what you think by heading on over to our Facebook feed or shooting us an email. This week, we've got some great stuff planned, just as you've heard in the top of the show. First and foremost, though, I have a really great press release, and I want to read this and then tell you a little bit about it. So, for immediate release, Southern California Research Lodge for Eternal Review Magazine. Number one, if you don't know what this is, and you've been living under a rock, I really want you to go over to theresearchlodge.com, check out their publication, and see what they're talking about. September 5th, South Pasadena, California. The editors of the Southern California Research Lodge's Fraternal Review are pleased to deliver to you an advanced copy of our September-October 2020 publication, The Masonic Style Issue. This is a double issue with over 50 pages of articles and images, all curated, and some written, by guest editor and Masonic scholar Brother Angel Millar, making the Masonic Style issue our biggest and boldest issue of the decade. In the issue, we explore the history, attitude, influence, and modern attitudes that make Freemasons dress up for lodge and proudly display their identity through the threads they wear. Freemasonry is one of the few organizations where it is expected for men to wear their best as they pay their reverence to the craft. But what truly defines your best threads has more to do with an individual's attitude and the acceptable culture of one's Masonic jurisdiction. Some of the questions contemplated in this issue are, what is it about putting on a suit that makes us feel upright? Why are Masonic symbols subliminally appearing in fabrics that runway designers are sending down the runways? How do the fabrics we wear reflect our identities? Are top hats the only headgear lodge masters are allowed to wear? What's up with the skull trend that keeps appearing on Masonic ties, handkerchiefs, and cufflinks? We are also excited to announce that for the first time in our publication's 62-year history, we've published a living Mason on the cover. Brother David Ybarra from South Pasadena's Masonic Lodge, number 290, who is a fellow craft and who braved the pandemic fears and leveled up for our hat photo shoot. With no modeling experience, he delivered some amazing shots while having a positive attitude over the whole 8-hour photo shoot experience. He was magnificently shot by the talented Letitia Burgess, who photographed all the original images you'll see in this issue. All models in the issue are Los Angeles County Freemasons who volunteered their time for the publication. Now, I'll tell you this, I can't say too much about what's in the magazine yet. I'm under Masonic obligation, but I will tell you, it is a phenomenal issue And the way it feels, if you're somebody who has flipped through a Style magazine, a GQ, or perhaps you know around this time of the year, there are several fashion magazines that have like these mega huge fashion issues. And they're really great to look at. You can get some cool looks down and decide on, you know, what look you want to go for this year, or maybe you want to try something else out. And this issue delivers that in a really cool way for the Freemason. They said it was the boldest issue in a decade. I have to agree. I thought the entire issue, every bit of it, was just fantastic. And I believe in the Fraternal Review magazine, so I just want to tell you all to go check that out at your earliest convenience. It's a great magazine. There is an article in there that was published on the Midnight Freemasons a while back that really got the cover story, I think, and will get you talking. So check it out. Again, theresearchlodge.com. I'll have a link in the show notes for you. Next up, Chicago Masonicon. This is happening in just a couple days. So if you're listening to this on Sunday night or Monday morning, this thing is happening in like 4 or 5 days. It's going to go off. It's going to be amazing. We're all done selling tickets. So if you have a ticket, awesome, and we'll see you there. If you don't have a ticket and you are interested in attending live in person, you can put your name on the waiting list. And if somebody cancels coming in person, I can email you back and then invoice you for an executive pass. So the next time we'll talk to you is after the MasonicCon event, and I'll be recording an episode before it actually happens. So I'm sure I will make some comments like, I know it was great. And I hope it is a wonderful event. Just recently, a podcast called Strictly Prohibited was released. It is a podcast where there's a Mason and a non-Mason, both one retired, one active duty military man. They actually had me on the show to talk about Freemasonry. So if that interests you, I'll put a link in the show notes. The episode's about an hour and 14, 15 minutes or something like that. Again, it's called Strictly Prohibited Podcast, and the hosts are Vic and Ian. They're really great guys. So you can check out their podcast via the link in the show notes. Want to give a quick mention about It's Business Time, Adapting a Corporate Path for Freemasonry, a book I wrote with John Ruark. He and I are big fans of business models and business strategies, whether that's agile or who moved the cheese, you name it. So we wrote a book where we adapted those particular strategies to Freemasonry. Adapted, not adopted, adapted. And we had it read by Brother Jared Stanley, who's the Grand Secretary of Mississippi, and also the host of What is a Mason? So if that interests you also, please head on over to Audible, where you can download it and you can listen to it. It's just a couple hours, and you can also get it on paperback as well. I want to go ahead and get to the education this week. This week's first piece comes from illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison, and it's called We Forgive You. I stood curbside at Chicago's O'Hare Airport waiting for my ride. I was there to speak at a Masonic event, and another one of the speakers walked up to me, introduced himself as a brother from Tennessee. I told him I was from Missouri, and we shook hands and he said, Steve, we forgive you. I knew exactly what he meant. The story, the Missouri side of it anyway, had come to me in a sort of bull session I had with the Grand Secretary of Missouri, at the time, Right Worshipful Brother Ron Miller. Back about 200 years ago, in fact, exactly 200 years ago, the territory that would soon become the state of Missouri had about 100 brothers who were members of three lodges spearheading an effort to form a Grand Lodge. The three lodges were Missouri Lodge 12, Joachim Lodge 25, and St. Charles Lodge 28, all chartered through the Grand Lodge of Tennessee. Today, the process of creating a new Grand Lodge might be a formal event accompanied by pomp and circumstance. Back then, however, when communication was a lot slower, things were different. The brothers from those three lodges got together, decided the time was right, and presto changeo, declared themselves to be a Grand Lodge. No pomp, no circumstance, no muss, no fuss. When you stop to think about it, any group today could do the same thing. Just get together and announce to the world, hey guys, look at us, we're a new Grand Lodge. There is one catch. The key to becoming a Grand Lodge is not declaration, it's recognition. Missouri's uppity declaration did not sit well with the Grand Lodge of Tennessee. It responded to Missouri's claim with a resounding, "Oh no, you're not a Grand Lodge." It seems the three lodges combined owed their mother Grand Lodge a total of $17, and it refused to recognize them until the debt was paid. Missouri disputed the claim. In the meantime, other Grand Lodges granted recognition to Missouri, which ultimately settled the issue and gave Missouri the backing to respond to Tennessee. "Oh yes, we are a Grand Lodge." Subsequent correspondence indicates Missouri did not follow its response with "na na 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 na," but the urge to do so may have been strong. So, at least between me and my new friend from Tennessee, this 2 centuries-old dispute now appears to have been settled, and the Grand Lodge of Missouri and the Grand Lodge of Tennessee can let bygones be bygones. We're still not paying the $17, though. Stephen L. Harrison, 33rd Degree. When I first read this, I had a chuckle. It was a really good one. You know, it really got me thinking about the way things were done in the past. And, $17 back then was quite a sum of money. But by Grand Lodge standards, was it? Is that a lot of money? You know, most Grand Lodges today have, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars even, if you're some Grand Lodges. But in any case, hilarious, and you just can't make this kind of stuff up. If this really interests you, if you like it, please head on over to wcypodcast.com, click on the bookstore, and check out Stephen's books. You can find a lot of his writing revolves around things he's edited for the Missouri Lodge of Research, another outstanding and phenomenal lodge of research, putting out hardcover books from time to time, including the 2-volume set on Ray V. Denslow, which is outstanding, which you can also get on Kindle if you got $10. Both volumes electronic, searchable. It's a really great deal. So again, check that out, and later on in this episode, of course, you know we've got a new Masonic Minute, so stay tuned. The next piece I have for you is called The Duties of a Mason in the Lodge. This is a paper that was submitted to me just not too long ago, and I thought it was a really nice paper. It was well written, it had some great bullets, and makes a solid point or two. But let's read it. The Duties of a Mason in the Lodge by Shishir Ratan, Lodge Start of the South, number 101, Grand Lodge, Ireland. Before we get into the topic, let us first be very clear about 2 key words here. Duty, a moral or legal obligation, a responsibility. Mason, a person skilled in cutting, dressing, and laying stone in buildings. Now, let's delve into the conjunction of the 2 words and see how they make sense together. If you consider someone as a skilled individual, it means one very important thing about such a person. He or she has dedicated time and effort into studying and practicing some act which was worthy of mastering, to the effect that it not only adds value to one's credibility, but also has value in the purview of a society. Such a person in that time and age is known for their unique and essential skill. Garnering respect and social standing is a reward for the many hours spent toiling away with the working tools and laying designs on their tracing board. Likewise, brethren, each of us has a duty that we ought to toil away at. Fortunately, our time and age does not need us to carry around heavy tools nor work on heavy stones or in dusty surroundings, like our ancient brethren once did. But, just like them, we still have a few things very much in common, and one of those is our duty as a Mason. It was alluded to when we were obligated as part of the ceremony of our initiation. I'd suggest you give it a fleeting moment to recollect that instant when the light was revealed to you, and you could barely see properly owing to the vision adjusting to the ambient brightness. The transition to the figurative light from darkness is similar, in that it's not immediately understood, but when it does become clear, there is nothing quite like it. In this talk, I'd like to draw your attention to what some of those duties are in practice. To the entered apprentice, I extend my warm welcome to the gentle craft as you begin pacing toward the fellow craft's lodge and the subsequent journey into the folds of masonry it is your duty to be curious, like a toddler that has only just begun to crawl on its knees. Explore the world of masonry around you by interacting with the brethren in your lodge, paying close attention to the ceremony being done for the newer brethren, and help them out because you and the initiates share a bond that is similar, that of dealing with the unfamiliar. At the same time, you have a bigger role to play, one that will begin your foray into the understanding of servant leadership by helping the worshipful master and the DOC with thoughtful acts of organizing things as the lodge opens, such as placing the collars on the officers' chairs, helping out with arranging the festive board and hosting the brethren. These are simple but very practical things that serve not only to help a lodge be prepared for its ceremonies on time, but also give you the opportunity to grow your interactions with the brethren of your lodge. A seed confined to its fruit is of no real use until it's out of its shell and interacts with the life-giving forces of the elements around it. To the fellow crafts, you are in a transitory phase where you are merely a step from being a master mason, but much ahead from the engulfing darkness out of which you emerged when you were initiated. Your duty holds an even bigger significance upon the future of the lodge, of nurturing the entered apprentices, as a big brother would take care of his very young siblings, and of preparing yourself to be able to help in the affairs of, and one day leading, the lodge as a master mason. Your time in the lodge will have given you a better understanding of how a lodge functions and the several logistical things that you can help out with. This experience is what must be imparted to the entered apprentices to help them break the ice and get involved with the lodge activities, much like a supervisor directs and demonstrates while serving the more pressing matters. The element of leading by example here is the key, since the entered apprentices have your conduct as a template to apply to themselves as they look forward to becoming a fellow craft in due course of time. And finally, to the Master Masons, my dear brethren, are the key that has been shaped as an entered apprentice, polished as a fellow craft, and finally applied as a Master Mason in the affairs of the lodge. Whether you're a day old in the third degree or 30 years old, the primary duty remains much like the clouds in the sky. They come in various forms, but they all rain down life-giving water upon the earth, so the seeds may sprout forth and the trees thrive. While some of you may wait to ascend the ladder, you can still be valuable assets to the lodge. One of the ways that I have personally experienced this is to be ready to substitute a missing officer. Let's all be practical here. Our time and age leaves us all with several preoccupations, some planned while some unplanned, and it is always possible that one fine day a brother might not be available due to the events out of his control. That, my brethren, is your chance to experience masonry from a different vantage point, by being involved in the ceremony as an active participant. I can personally vouch that the experience of watching a ceremony from the benches and actively participating in it are worlds apart. It fires your imagination as the new perspective enriches your curiosity, and the experience fuels your enthusiasm to be more involved in lodge activities. In summary, regardless of which degree you might be in, brethren, we all may seem to have different duties, but in essence, all of it culminates into one goal: building, maintaining, and enliving the lodge and Freemasonry at large. As an entered apprentice, you might ponder if the common gavel is of any use, while in fact, without your effort, the more expert workman will have to spend more time smoothing it when he could have rather spent his effort in perfecting the rough ashlar. A fellow craft can use his time to impart his knowledge to enable the new workman while preparing himself for a higher pedestal, while a master mason forges ahead with the support of his lodge, learning from the experiences of his predecessors and showing the way to his officers into the vast unknown path carved forth by the arrow of time. I thank you for your time, brethren. I hope you will ponder over what I had to share with you and seek out opportunities to not only be more active in the lodge, but also find ways to gain experiences by volunteering as much as you can. This concludes the piece on the duties of a Mason in the Lodge. I found the piece to be edifying and, if I'm honest, a little inspiring. I hope it did the same for you. We'll have the paper as a download in this week's bonus features of the app. Let's get into this week's Masonic Minute with illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison.
Francis Rowden Hastings, the second Earl of Moria, who lived from 1754 to 1826, was a British soldier and colonial administrator. From 1790 until 1813, he was acting Grand Master to His Royal Highness George, Prince of Wales, who later became King George IV, and in 1806 and 1807, he served as Grand Master of Scotland. At the end of the 18th century, he tirelessly and nearly single-handedly worked to defeat the Unlawful Societies Act of 1799, which would have effectively outlawed Freemasonry. Aside from a few provisions which had little effect on the craft, he was successful in his efforts and in a very real sense saved Freemasonry in Great Britain. On July 12, 1804, he married Flora Muir Campbell, the 6th Countess of Loudoun. Together, from 1806 to 1812, they had no less than 6 children, one of whom died in infancy. In 1813, George III appointed him Governor General of India. His country calling, he accepted the position, but it was deemed inadvisable for his wife to accompany him with 5 children ranging in age from 1 to 7. He made the trip to India alone and served for nearly a decade. He resigned in 1823 and returned home to his family. Then, in 1824, George IV appointed him Governor of Malta, separating him from his family once again. It is not known how often Hastings and his wife were able to be together after the appointments that took him far from home. However, an unusual request in his will indicates his dedication to her. On a sea voyage in 1826, perhaps returning for a visit home, he fell ill and died. His body was returned to Malta, where his grave is located today. The unusual provision in his will, however, was that his right hand be cut from his body and buried with his wife at her death. His wish was granted. Lady Flora died in 1840, and eternally his hand rests, clasped in hers, buried in the family vault in the old Kirk Church in Loudoun. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right, again with the phenomenal history, the Unlawful Societies Act that went through the UK at the time, these kind of harrowing tales of mythic proportions that just make our minds boggle today. Life was such an adventure back then. You know, I almost hope that somebody is documenting what we're doing today, and maybe there's a few Freemasons out there who can be remembered in such a cool way, and maybe there's a Stephen L. Harrison somewhere in the future writing about you. But nonetheless, the present day, Stephen L. Harrison, eternal thanks for what you do for this program and the history that you bring us to tell us all of these things that we otherwise might not know anything about. But the real benefit is, while these things are coming to us, they might be jogging a sense of curiosity in you, and maybe you want to go pick up and learn more. So you go to the library, or you go to the Masonic Lodge, or a lodge of research, and you pull more information, and you get more context and more story. And that's really what I love. So once again, thanks to illustrious Brother Harrison for your time and putting these together. For everybody else out there listening, I want you to know that these videos, that's right, there are videos that go along with these. You can find them on our YouTube channel at WCY Podcast or the Whence Came You Podcast on YouTube. Like and subscribe, all that good stuff. So thanks once again. And now I want to read something that is sure to be, well, controversial. Recently, Arturo de Hoyos posted on his Facebook a post that was really well written. The post was mostly about brothers who tend to get, well, should we say, up in arms about political topics being discussed, as if being a Freemason alone is enough to stop you in your tracks, in your everyday life, talking about politics. Well, we know that's not the case, but we also know that perhaps not everything is meant for social media. There are, to be sure, political biases that exist throughout the world that some people find so comforting, while others find them absolutely abhorrent. But the study of politics, the study of the philosophy of democracy, is absolutely fair game. And so what I want to read to you now is a Freemason's view, well, when they ask a question philosophically, a thought experiment, if you will, about the Electoral College. So from the Masonic Philosophical Society, recapturing the spirit of the Renaissance, should the U.S. Electoral College be abolished? By Elaine Polonius Fellin, September 9, 2019. Many Americans uphold the U.S. Constitution as a visionary document drafted in a spirit of equality and encouraging the maximum democratic participation for all voters. The preamble's introductory line, "We the people of the United States, in order to establish a more perfect union," seems to imply that all citizens of our nation would be involved in the process of creating and directing the government. In reality, however, the framers of the Constitution only provided a small voting role for the general electorate. The drafters intended that only members of the U.S. House of Representatives would be subject to direct election by the general voting population. In contrast, the U.S. Senators and the U.S. President would be indirectly elected for longer terms of office. Indirect versus direct democracy. In the Federalist Papers, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton wrote against the concept of direct elections of the president and senators. Alexander Hamilton stated that the objective of the Electoral College was to preserve, quote, the sense of the people, end quote, while at the same time ensuring that the president is chosen by, quote, unquote, men most capable of analyzing the qualities adapted to the station and acting under circumstances favorable to deliberation and to a judicious combination of all the reasons and inducements which were proper to govern their choice, end quote. In his papers, number 49 and number 63, Madison argued that giving ordinary citizens the right to elect their president would mean that, quote unquote, the passions, therefore not the reason, of the public would sit in judgment. Moreover, the indirect election plan would protect the American public against their own temporary errors and delusions, quote unquote, their violent passions and popular fluctuations. Alexander Hamilton's Federalist Papers number 68 advocated for indirect elections as a means to avoid, quote unquote, tumult and disorder and violent movements. Have indirect elections for the U.S. presidents protected the country from irrational and delusional public voting? In contrast to appointing others to vote on one's behalf, direct democracy describes when citizens make decisions about elections and policy in person without going through representatives and legislatures. In this context, direct democracy means that the individual citizen could cast a vote which would then be counted to determine which candidate would be elected. Another example of direct democracy granted to citizens, including to citizens in Colorado and 20 other U.S. states, is the power of initiative, which by a petition signed by a certain minimum number of registered voters can bring about a public vote on a proposed law or constitutional amendment. Should U.S. citizens be given the right to direct democracy at the federal level? The constitutional limits to direct democracy. The Electoral College was not the only limit the founders included on direct democracy in the Constitution, though we have discarded most of those limitations. Senators were initially to be appointed by state legislatures, and states were permitted to ban women from voting entirely. Slaves were also denied the right to vote, and a slave only counted as 3/5 of a person in the determination and the number of legislators a state would receive in Congress. The 14th Amendment abolished the 3/5 rule and granted male former slaves the right to vote. The 15th Amendment abolished the federal and state government's authority to deny a citizen the right to vote based on that citizen's race, color, or previous condition of servitude. The 17th Amendment made senators subject to direct election, and the 19th Amendment gave women the right to vote. The U.S. Constitution's requirement for electing the president. James Madison and Alexander Hamilton's indirect voting philosophy informed the drafting of the U.S. Constitution, which outlines the method of selecting in the president in clauses 2, 3, and 4 of Article 2, Section 1. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2. Each state shall appoint, in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct, a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress. But no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector. Under the U.S. Constitution, by means of a constitutional grant of authority to the state legislatures, the president and vice president are chosen by electors. This system allows each state to determine the means by which it will create its state college of electors. In current practice, state legislatures create their panel of electors by indirect popular vote. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 3. The electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot. They shall make a list of all the persons voted for and of the number of votes for each, which list they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of the government of the United States, directed to the President of the Senate. The President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall then be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes shall be the president. If such number be a majority of the whole number of electors appointed. Note, this clause was changed by the 12th Amendment in 1804. Each individual state chooses its electors in the popular election. Once chosen, the electors meet in their respective states to cast ballots for the president and vice president. In the case where no presidential candidate receives a majority of electoral votes, the House chooses from the top three candidates. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 4. The Congress may determine the time of choosing the electors and the day on which they shall give their votes, which day shall be the same throughout the United States. Congress determines the national election day, which has been determined to be the Tuesday following the first Monday in November, in the year before the president's term is to expire. Then, the electors cast their votes on the Monday following the second Wednesday in December of that year. The votes are then opened and counted by the Vice President, as President of the Senate, in a joint session of Congress. The Constitution does not include a requirement that the electors cast their votes to match the voting outcome of the popular elections within the state, the Electoral College. The political philosophy that ordinary citizens were not qualified to choose their leaders was common practice in the early years of popular voting. Instead, nations made use of indirect voting, whereby the voters would elect a group of representatives to select public leaders on their behalf. The Electoral College is the last vestige of this arcane system still operating in the United States. Thus, when Americans go vote for the president on Election Day, they are not voting for the president. Instead, they are choosing representatives who will vote on their behalf. In each state, the voters are technically choosing between the group of electors who have been elected or appointed months prior to the election. The electors are then pledged to support their own party's presidential candidate. The Electoral College operates on a system of 538 total electoral votes for the 50 states and the District of Columbia. To win the general election, 270 votes are needed for a candidate. Each state is entitled to a number of electoral votes, equal to the combined number of senators plus the number of U.S. representatives for that state. For example, Montana has a single member of Congress and two senators. Thus, Montana receives 3 electoral votes in the presidential contest. In contrast, California has 53 members of Congress and 2 senators, receiving 55 electoral votes. Following the general election on the Tuesday after the first Monday of November, the winning balloted electors travel to their state capital to formally cast their votes on the Monday following the second Wednesday in December. While rare, electors have in the past broken their pledges and voted for a different candidate. Although most states have passed statutes binding their electors to their pledges, 30 today, constitutional authorities have raised doubts as to whether these state laws would be enforceable in a national election. In the 2016 presidential election, 6 U.S. electors broke with tradition to vote against their state's popular vote tallies. The largest number of quote-unquote faithless electors seen in a century. 4 U.S. electors declined to vote for Hillary Clinton, and 2 electors refused to vote for Donald Trump. Should the electors of the Electoral College be allowed to vote their conscience? While the popular vote usually correlates with the election of the president, there have been exceptions in American history. 1824 election. There was no majority winner in the Electoral College. 4 candidates split the vote. John Quincy Adams, Andrew Jackson, Henry Clay, and William H. Crawford. The election was sent to the House of Representatives, who chose John Quincy Adams, despite Andrew Jackson winning the popular and electoral votes. The choice was the ultimate result of what is historically referred to as the corrupt bargain, devised and executed by Adams and Clay. In 1876, Samuel Tilden was chosen by the popular vote, but the special commission overruled the vote, electing President Rutherford B. Hayes instead. In 1888 election, Grover Cleveland received more popular votes, but the Electoral College elected Benjamin Harrison. 2000 election, Al Gore won the popular vote with 48.4% of the vote, but President George W. Bush won the Electoral College with 271 votes, following the recount in Florida. Gore received approximately 540,000 more votes nationwide than Bush. This vote count, however, pales in comparison to the 2016 presidential election final vote tally. In the 2016 election, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote with nearly 3 million more votes than President Donald Trump. According to the nonpartisan Cook Political Report, Clinton received approximately 2,864,974 more votes nationwide than Trump. Donald Trump won the presidency by securing 306 Electoral College votes, which is 36 more than the 270 votes needed to claim victory. Thus, in 53 of the 58 total elections, the winner of the national popular vote has also carried the Electoral College vote. Equality and justice in the American elections. Do Americans still lack the responsibility and reasoning necessary to elect the president? Must we still be protected against our own quote-unquote temporary errors and delusions, and our quote-unquote violent passions, as James Madison argued? Freemasonry rests under the banner of the universality of all mankind and operates under the principles of tolerance, justice, and equality. When American citizens are withheld the electoral power to choose our president, are we truly operating as we the people? Can we form a more perfect union when we voluntarily abdicate our voting choices to others deemed to be more rational and less ruled by passions? Perhaps we need to realize the responsibility inherent in acting as mature adults, subdue our unruly passions, and advocate for equal voting rights in the election of the U.S. president. This is a very interesting thing to think about today, specifically Masonically. I know a lot of people are going to be listening to this particular episode and just rolling their eyes or, you know, gripping the steering wheel really tightly, thinking, why am I reading this? I'm not picking a side, I'm not talking about anything, I'm just merely stating facts. And I think it bears a really good philosophical kind of question when we think about how Freemasons helped form this great experiment almost 250 years ago. We've done quite a bit of changing. We've changed a lot of the ways we do things, and it sure does make you wonder, regardless of who would be in office. I want you to not think about that, but if we're thinking about just the mere ability to make your vote really count, is that worth something? Is that a Masonic tenet? Is that true equality, justice, if you will? It sure does make me think. And I know I'll be doing a lot of that going up into the political season. You know, I do urge everybody to go out and pay attention to your electorate voters and to make sure that you're taking part in the great experiment. But also understand how all of this works so that you can effectively be a real part of how this country, this great experiment, is governed. My thanks again goes out to, of course, Elaine Polonius Fellin, who published this last year, actually, September 9th, about a year ago. And you can find that at the Masonic Philosophical Society. I'll have a link back to their website in our show notes as well. But that's it for this week. I hope you have enjoyed. I hope I gave you something to think about. I hope I didn't enrage anybody too much by talking about politics. I wasn't going, again, I'm not giving a side here. I'm not picking a side. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the process and how, when viewed through the lens of Freemasonry, what's right, what's wrong, what's equal, what isn't. In any case, I want to thank the supporters of this show, the producers, contributors, the fellows. Thank you so much for your continued support. Thank you for everybody who has bought tickets to MasonicCon Chicago. I'll see you there. I'll see you online. And that's it for this week. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.